Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Ever wonder what really happens behind the scenes in construction, real estate, and development? We pull back the curtain on the new home construction industry, the real estate market, and the trends shaping it all. Discover the stories, insights, and expertise behind the process of building a new home. Join us for Trust the Process podcast, and let's build something great together. Welcome back to Trust the Process, the podcast where we talk about new home industry, real estate, construction, and everything in between. So today's kind of a fun, we're mixing it up a little bit. Shot out a few weeks ago on our social media platforms the request for questions. As we go about our days, obviously we work in the real estate industry and we are working in the builder industry, and so we see a lot of vendors and subcontractors and clients and buyers and agents and other people that we work with. We get a lot of questions.
Yeah.
So thought it would be fun to put that out to you guys and let you lead us in some of the questions or topics that you wanted to hear. So with that, we got some good response, and so we're going to jump into some of these questions, and maybe if somebody else had the question, it's something you might be wondering too. So hopefully we can answer some of those. So we'll start with, and I just put them on note cards.
Oh, okay.
Pulled them from the replies and put them onto note cards for us. So we'll just start. I'll go ahead and let you read the question and then offer your reply, and I'll chime in on answers too if there's some stuff that that we can do together.
This one's for me. It says, how did you get so handsome? I don't know.
That was for me.
That's good stuff. That's good rebuttal. Dang it, I thought I had the corner on the market on that one. So this question is, and this is probably in line with our trends podcast, and it is multifamily the answer to our housing shortage? I agree that it is a really important piece of our housing shortage, both multifamily for sale and multifamily for rent. More passionate about multifamily for sale. I think that you can still get that pride of ownership, and multifamily product is great for entry level and, to say it, exit level, if you're kind of, maybe that's your last home.
Sure, or you want to be able to travel and
still
so
be able to travel, and you've had many, many homes, and this is something that you can kind of downsize into. Maybe it has amenities, and there's zero maintenance, and I think that there's a lot of demand in the market for everything, especially in fast-growing cities. So do I think it's the answer? I think what they're probably getting at is there's something called the missing middle. So you have super high density and then suburban, and that's most U.S. cities. We have these because that's, you know, housing policy is that it favors suburbia, like we talked about.
Okay.
So we have a missing middle. Whereas when you go to Europe, a lot of the East Coast cities, a lot of these cities feel really vibrant. It's because of that middle housing stock, the five-story mixed use parks, that type of thing, the walkability that we don't have here. And then you get into more low density, either suburban or rural. So I think it's that, is that missing middle the answer to our housing shortage? That would go a long way. I think that that's a pipe dream to think that we're going to see cities have an about face and suddenly allow for this missing middle. And for other reasons we already talked about in our zoning episode, it's just not politically popular to densify around your constituents. So you're always going to see a lean towards what's in the area already.
There has been a push for multifamily, though, in recent years.
Years ago,
you didn't see much of it. And then there were a few builders that pulled out in front with kind of taking the lead on doing that. And now most all, you know,
big production builders offer
some sort
that's right
for purchase.
Oh, yeah.
multi-level product or multi-family product, and so attached in some way. So definitely changing the number of homes that we can build. We can put more homes into the marketplace because of them, but their question was if it's going to turn around the shortage. Not likely, but it certainly does make a better dent in it.
It does. When one project can deliver 300 doors, that same piece of land might develop 80
three, single four, family five. Homes. Some are delivering over the thousands in their door counts.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Next question. I'm kind of thumbing through them. I should probably just randomly toss them at you.
So I'm not prepared.
This one I love, and we hear it all the time. So yes.
This person did not mince words. So this person
said, "Who that was too?"
Why do? So this is HOA suck. Why do we need them?
Why do we need them? So many people who live in an HOA, or if they're looking for a home, that's one of the first things. I have to be in an HOA, or I don't want an HOA. It's a very polarizing topic.
I agree, and I just had a spirited board meeting for my own HOA for some things that I did to my house that weren't approved. So it's fresh for me. And
they make a lot of decisions, and you live under some
with them in some ways.
For sure.
And they kind of replicate, you know, I'm from the East Coast, right? So these small little towns have a lot of authority, and they are in your life. So yes, we don't have HOAs in upstate New York, but we have a lot of little towns that if you paint your porch the wrong color, someone from the city or the town will come after you. So I was having flashbacks when I was fighting with my board, and I promise I was not the one that put that question in there.
No.
But they do suck, I promise you.
No, it was a conversation.
Yeah. I was fighting with my board, and the couple of the improvements I made were improvements that everyone in my community has made, behind the same gates. So it was frustrating that I had to justify these actions. But I've never felt more under the thumb of an HOA than the last couple of weeks, so this is a very apropos question. Mm-hmm. Now, why do we need them? So it's
We need them?
I wish that we didn't, but if we want the growth and we want single family residential, which as much as we like to talk about multifamily and the missing middle, why is there a premium on single family versus multifamily? That tells you that yes, they're a little bit more expensive to build, but they are more desirable.
Mm-hmm. And usually is in a multifamily as well.
So, of course, of course. So, but as long as you want this single family residential lifestyle and you don't want to live in a apartment block and you don't want to live, you know, in one of these high dense areas, as long as you want your little slice, you're going to have to probably partake in the HOA, HOA process, because cities do not want to approve new development that does not have, especially larger scale developments, that doesn't have an HOA piece with it.
Right.
Because they don't want the street maintenance. They don't want the park maintenance. They want the developer to take on those burdens, and then they want the developer to hand it over to the homeowner. So if you have common elements, such as in Las Vegas and most suburban areas, especially when the streets are gated, but even not always, the streets are private. They're privately maintained streets that the HOA has to do slurry coats over.
Right.
Someone's got to do it. They have to keep the gutters in good repair. They have to repair cracks. They have to take on liability of someone falling on that sidewalk. It doesn't fall into the city's jurisdiction anymore. So cities love HOAs. And that's really I don't feel, yes, it's polarizing, but I do feel like a lot more people don't like HOAs than do like HOAs.
Until their neighborhood starts to look a wreck, and then you wish that there was somebody
governing.
Then you
wish you had someone kind of governing it. There are probably no other mechanisms that would be able to enforce neighborhood standards that would not be an HOA. Because if you give somebody power to do that, if you just have a community association that's literally just a neighborhood pact,
right,
you have no legal mechanism, so therefore your laws are just recommendations. So the states had to give HOAs a lot of authority. And trust me, when I'm fighting with the board, I want to be able to tell them to do what with you know what. But I can't, because I know that they do have an authority over my property in the same way that I can't just decide to go to war with the city. I can't just decide to stop paying my property taxes. The city has rights over my property, and the state has rights over that. I mean, there's always these layers, and it's just when you live in an HOA, you have that one extra layer. Mm-hmm. So that's why we need them to continue to grow. Without that, I think our property taxes would be significantly higher. And I think you would see, although it's very sludgy to get development approved, I think it would be even slower. And I think you'd probably see caps on the amount of permits issued, because they'd say we have to slow down our growth because we're not going to be able to maintain this. And it's all fun and games when the cities are growing, but when the cities are built out, these East Coast suburbs that were post-war suburbs in Maryland and Virginia, those were post-war, so that was 50s, you know, late 40s, 50s. Those are now 75 years old, a lot of those suburbs. They are not sustainable. They're almost always broke. The taxes are through the roof. They usually are in charge of their own school districts, so the schools are sucking out a lot of the funding. And road maintenance, snow removal, things like that, it just becomes untenable. So you, because they're built out, and they're not getting permit fees, and they're not, the housing stock is old, so how much can you jack the property taxes up on residents who have been there for 40 years? There's just only so much you can do to increase revenue, but your expenses are going up every single year. So the West Coast, you know, the west of the Mississippi and the, you know, the Southeast, basically the Sun Belt, cities were smart in the 90s from a city preservation standpoint to say we want to preserve the books of the city, to really mandate HOAs, which is why you see a sharp increase in HOAs in the late 90s and through the, you know, the 2000s and into today. So that's why we need them. And trust me, I don't like them either. I resent the authority that they have. But at the end of the day, what how do you give them any teeth? You have to give them that kind of legally mandated authority or state prescribed authority.
Yep. But it was a good question, so thank you.
Yes.
And it's a good topic. It's an interesting topic and one that and it, isn't going anywhere. So.
It's funny how it feathers into development so much. I mean, you would think, and I get it, of course, developers have a big part with HOA, but it really is. It's not just a developer going, do we want an HOA here? Yes or no? And it's not market driven either. So you would think that because there's so many HOAs, it must be market driven. People must pursue that. People must favor HOAs. That's not really the case. So I think it's the city and, you know, the local governments with their finger on the scale to say, well, everything's going to have an HOA.
Okay, yeah. Next. I don't like this one, but I do feel like it's it's one that we should probably address. They all are. That's on the back of each of them. So,
this is
a
good one.
Tough one and a little painful for you to read because it's
it comes
right at you, or it seems to come right at builders as a whole. So.
And they didn't have to say that about my hair.
Don't read that part.
It says, "Why are builders so greedy, especially with upgrades?" You jerk. I get what they're saying. I think that especially this, I feel like this probably came from a real estate agent.
Did it?
Okay. Because agents are many times on the cutting edge of price increases and, you know, they're delivering that.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed-sponsored jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed-sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
News to their buyers if they're bringing a buyer to a builder, and it looks like greed, and some of it is. Most builders are publicly traded. Most builders that build any volume of homes are publicly traded, so they have growth as their mandate, not just doing business. They have to grow, meaning their profits. They don't necessarily have to put more homes in the ground. They have to grow their profits, so they get there through many different, you know, vehicles or modalities. So they can either build more homes, which we know the constraints on that land and the approval and at the time, or they can charge more for homes or upsell things that are considered extras, such as upgrades. So it's not that they're necessarily being greedy, but at the end of the day, there are no charitable home builders except Habitat for Humanity.
Right.
So every builder has a profit.
It's a for-profit industry.
It's a for-profit industry, and you can argue what someone's mission is, but at the end of the day, the mission of any company is to increase profits for their shareholders. That is just their mission, whether their shareholders are publicly traded shareholders or the owners of the company. I mean, that is the... Now, the owners within the company can have greater missions and say, this is my overall goal. But the company itself, that is its goal, that is its purpose. So it's always going to preserve that. So that being said, the larger a builder gets, the more disconnected from their buyer pool that the executives and their decision makers are, in my opinion. I don't want to be inflammatory, but they feel more disconnected. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to say, oh, we could make another 10% on this project if we dial down what's included and make people pay extra. And because they're doing it through us, we can control the pricing because you can't shop it. You can't shop how much darker cabinets are versus lighter cabinets because mm-hmm. you're here, you're on our playground. Mm-hmm. So you play by our rules. So I will concede that builders are greedy. I will concede that it's a high profit margin business, but it is a business with a very high barrier to entry and a lot of risk and downside to it as well. So mm-hmm. it's easy for me to say this now, but what if things change in the next 3 to 5 years and you say, well, I'm glad we had that arsenal mm-hmm. in our tool chest because we were able to weather these storms because we were able to increase margins mm-hmm. on previous projects and weather the storm. And mm-hmm. it's hard because at the same time, you're creating, you can argue, housing is a human right for a lot of people. I mean, it's definitely a human necessity.
Sure.
So you're creating something that's deeply needed. So I think that there's a resentment that comes with that, just like you might resent oil companies because you feel like, well, we need them. We need gas. Yeah. Right? We need gasoline for our car and you're charging this and your mm-hmm. profits were this and you're right. Yes, I get it. They're making something that is a necessity, but they are a business and it's not a builder's responsibility. I can have a mission in my life that I would love to put more homes into the ground or change the way home building is done. But at the end of the day, it's not my responsibility to make the real estate market affordable or make it, in some way better. My responsibility is to my company, and my company's responsibility is to uh-huh. stay in business and to mm-hmm. stay a company. So
I agree. I would argue that, yes, but I would also argue that some of that, if you're buying a home, let's just compare it to a resale home that yeah. isn't anything that you want. You have to go in and put in mm-hmm. the cupboards. And now you have your demo costs. And or even if they were to buy a home with you, yeah. one of our homes that's completely finished and it's the wrong cabinet color, let's just use that as yeah. an example. They've got to go in. They've got to do the demo. Yeah. They've got to hire the labor. They have to order the product. They have to. So all of those things.
Those variables that now they're shouldering. Right.
Sure. So it is a real cost. It's a hard cost. It's an yeah. absolute cost. And it's something that has to be factored in either way. So it's a convenience.
That's perfect.
Greed so, or convenient? I don't know, but there is a fine walk between.
And I think that another thing that makes us look greedier is that new homes carry around a 25% premium over resale homes. That's just the market speaking. I can't dictate the market, mm-hmm. good or bad. So if my homes carry an extra 25% margin, or even your average production home carries a 25% margin over a 15-year-old home, mm-hmm. it looks like the builder is charging $750,000 right. for the same thing you could get as a resale for $625,000 or $600,000. But what you're not factoring into the equation is that all those components are near the end of their functional life. All the expensive things are coming up yep. due, or if it's a 25-year-old home, all your windows mm-hmm. need to be replaced, or and components, mm-hmm. or the floor plans are dated. The market value is there at about a 25% premium. So I think that's part of it as well. It's that, yes, we are here to maximize our profits, and overall, you're good at your business. I feel like if you have a mission that's greater than that, because right. that's the passion that people can feel, but ultimately, profits have to come first. Otherwise, you can't do the project for charity, right? I mean, you just can't. Yeah. Otherwise, I would open a charity, and I don't want to do that. So I think that's part of it. It's multifaceted.
Okay.
But yes, are we good. Greedy with our upgrades? Sometimes, yes. But we have to own that, too. You want to mm-hmm. have, we're at dirt, or we're at slab, and we're at framing, and you want to add this, this, and this, and well, now we have to own that more complex build, and we have to source it all, and we have to, now we're customizing it for you, so if you bail on us, and we only get $20,000 of your deposit, mm-hmm. we have to maybe take a $100,000 hit on that house, so mm-hmm. we have to build in that risk as well.
I actually had that happen. Somebody put a red quartz throughout the entire house.
Oh.
Red quartz countertops, and then the home fell through, and they weren't able to buy it, and so then we had to remarket that. We actually, in that case, ended up taking it
out. Did you change them?
We did, but it was that kind of, oh my gosh, now we're stuck with this. And yeah. sometimes somebody will go to the design studio, and you're doing exactly that. Oh gosh, I really hope they
really
get
hope
this house.
Will. Yeah,
yeah. So there is a risk to be associated. I have a lot of that too.
Right.
Okay, so next question. Thanks for tuning into the Trust the Process podcast. Make sure to follow us on Spotify to stay in the loop with the latest insights, project updates, and everything in between. See you next time. Next question. That one we kind of covered. So, oh, here's a good one. This one actually came up for us this week in a client conversation. So that is an important one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is really good, and I think this is a developing situation. This is, what do you think the NAR settlement means for builders? This could probably be an entire episode. But
I agree. No, yeah, it could.
Probably could. But there's probably so much content out there for this. But for anyone who's not following it, that's maybe mm-hmm. in our audience, essentially that the class action lawsuit judgment came down in August that mm-hmm. said listing brokers can no longer advertise buyer agent commissions, and buyer's agents have to negotiate directly with their buyer how much they're going to charge. And you can ask for that as part of your contract when you present your offer, but every offer is going to have unique compensation. So that buyer might be working for 1% or 2% of that, mm-hmm. that buyer's agent, I mean. So they might ask for these varying levels of commission that is going to affect the offer. So when you're a developer, you're a seller more than anything, right? I mean, really, I have to sell X number of homes this year and next year and hopefully for many years to come. So I have a policy in place that I have a set number that I'm willing to give to someone who brings me a buyer.
Sure.
And what I'm doing is I'm rolling that into one larger percentage, and then the buyer, let's just call it 5%. That buyer can have that discussion with their agent to say, hey, can we keep 3% of this to pay for our closing costs? And you have 2% compensation. That's a conversation between them and the buyer's agent. So I am not privy to that at all. I don't care how it goes because I've conceded to this dollar amount. I was used to paying commissions anyway, so I've conceded to this dollar amount, this percentage, mm-hmm. and it's per house, depending on how desirable I think the home is or neighborhood. So there's one neighborhood that I just dialed it up an extra percent across the board because we have a lot of homes to get rid of in there. And it's a slower moving market, and I want to get some of those off my books. So I feel that that's a good enticing way for me to drive traffic. So I think it's overall a good thing. I think that it's forcing buyers agents to be more transparent. It's allowing sellers a lot more flexibility. So you're seeing that kind of maybe a not so good offer mm-hmm. is matched with a not so good compensation because that buyer's agent's bringing you a non-phenomenal is the mm-hmm. buyer you could probably get walking out on the street and find that kind of buyer. Mm-hmm. So I like that it's more tied to the other terms of the of the offer. Mm-hmm. So I think for builders, most builders are going to have to come up with some sort of policy. And I'm small, so I can't imagine, these other larger builders just said, no, this is just what we're offering out. So I don't think it affects builders that much, but it is putting downward pressure on commissions, mm-hmm. I feel. So I think if I can still have the same amount of traffic, mm-hmm. or when I keep my rates normal that I'm willing mm-hmm. to pay out, that will maybe drive traffic because everyone around me is
sure.
bringing and holding down their rates that they're paying.
Mm-hmm. And when it was first announced, or when the settlement first came down in, I believe it was July of 2024.
Yeah, July implemented by August.
Mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think there was a fear that surrounded it, and everybody kind of went into a panic. Builders world wasn't sure how it would affect them on that side. Sellers, agents, listing agents, all of that. Everybody kind of had a little moment, if you will. But overall, I think it's been a pretty non-issue. I mean, I agree that it forces agents to be more transparent. It's a conversation that wasn't being had before, that was being had in somewhat, I don't want to say shady, but it just
definitely
wasn't
more veiled.
In a pure light. So yeah. I think it just brings that to the forefront. Commissions are real. It's part of the real estate industry and part of how homes are transacted. And so having that as a forefront mm-hmm. conversation with your buyer or seller, I think is a value add to them and to the whole experience. And it creates a more professional environment for the industry as a whole. So
I think it makes it more competitive.
Agreed.
Right. So
yeah.
Anytime you have more competition, I think you have better outcomes.
Yeah.
It might be bumpy for a little while in the mm-hmm. beginning, but I think ultimately it will mm-hmm. lead to better outcomes.
But don't you think that a lot of the panic that was, I don't even want to call it panic, but a lot of the anxiety that was
bated
created
breath.
By that?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think, do you feel like you've seen...
Yeah, I think it's subsided. I think
yeah.
that it's real estate is a high
really...
turnover business anyway. So I feel that there's maybe people that were on the fence to get out of the mm-hmm. industry. Maybe that forced them out of the industry. Mm-hmm. There are people who would have gotten in but didn't because mm-hmm. they heard about the turmoil. So.
Or think it's easy. It's yeah. easy to get into real estate. And but if you don't have all of those pieces in place, you're just
right.
not going to survive it.
So it made it more complicated. But
yeah.
but
yeah.
I think it's a good thing.
I agree.
It will leave better agents on the table.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. Good question. You know who you are.
<I'm>
yes. Next one, let's talk about, this one's a little close to my heart. I love that one. So yeah, let's talk about design.
What do you think the future of design is? So there's a couple of, I mean, this could be home design. I'm just going to assume they're talking about everything.
And it didn't clarify what exactly. it could be any. It could be interior design. It could be functional design. Yeah. Sure.
So outside in, I think.
Community design.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Oh, community design. I would love to think maybe we see more mixed use. I would love to think we have more walkability, but I don't know if that's a pipe dream or not. Mm-hmm. So outside in, I think there will be architecture and design is going to be informed by building costs because it is to this day. Because at the end of the day, like we said, the majority of new doors created are from production builders. So they are penny pinchers and bean counters. So the extra eave embellishments and things that you may have seen in the 90s and early 2000s when margins were there to support that and there was more competition back to our, that's the other kind of C word, the competition, home building is so much more consolidated now, so home builders don't have to do that. In the most consolidated markets, for lack of a better word, the homes are the ugliest, in my opinion. if you have only five or six publicly traded builders that are creating inventory, the pressure is not there to make a product that really stands out, especially when you're in a housing shortage. So I think from the outside in, we'll see cost informing a lot of exterior design, simple roof lines, a lot of simple footprints that are probably two-story to capture land and capture, the economies of the building up versus building out.
We're seeing a lot of that.
A lot of vertical three-story to get a 1,900 square foot home in a footprint that may have only been a 1,200. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing kind of, I think, those things informing design, and then builders are doing their best to work within those constraints. And then going inside with floor plans, I think that the era of the purely open floor plan might be drawing to a close. I think you might start seeing, especially in your larger homes, I think you're going to start seeing a little bit more room division again. And I've read some blogs and that's some of that secondhand information, but I'm already feeling it from buyers and they're wanting those extra spaces. They're wanting those flex rooms where they can have pool tables or bars offices.
Still like the great room. Everybody still loves the great room concept.
I think the great room concept.
But I think additional, kind of going back to that formal living or a den or a,
I think
a
those
family
kind of third
room.
Spaces.
So you've got
that,
the great room and then a separate.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Those semi-private spaces. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see that, and I think we're going to see the emphasis on large kitchens still being ever-present. And I think in the luxury homes, we'll see now more than ever the prep kitchens and the mess kitchens.
Seeing
I think
a lot
that's
more of
definitely
that. You're building
something.
Some of that. So
we are doing.
Yes,
we've done some
yes,
of that, and it's
have.
Been
yes.
very, very well received. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. We're going to see a lot of large pantries. We're going to see the Costco door, maybe. It's a fire nightmare, but there are these little doors that go right from the garage into the pantry, and it's usually a small door that only a kid could get through.
Yes.
And then
it's
it'll
kind
go
of a
right.
Dreamy thought.
They call
you
it
just,
a,
yeah, you
they call it a
put
Costco
your big
door.
Water,
yeah.
You know, case right. or all those things right into the pantry.
Yeah. So I think we're going to see the kind of those little things in new home construction. I think we're going to see an additional push towards energy efficiency. So you may see windows deleted and things. You know, those are all perforations in your home, so you're going to see that in the more middle market homes. I think as you go into the luxury, the indoor-outdoor living, at least in the Sun Belt, is really emphasized. I think that's not going anywhere.
I think windows are only getting bigger.
I agree. In the luxury stuff, the windows are only getting bigger. The doors are getting bigger. The window walls are getting bigger. So I think that's kind of what we'll continue to see. I think volume ceilings are going to be here to stay. But that being said, I think the era of that great room. It's just one big room with a 14-foot ceiling on a single story. I think you're going to start to see some more second and third spaces in those homes and in those floor plans that will give people kind of refuge away from those big, hard to climatize, hard to control rooms. Mm-hmm. So, and then in terms of aesthetics, I think we're in an era of earth tones and beiges and creams, and I think we're getting away from the stark, shiny finishes of the middle 2010s and the moderns. Is that, do you agree?
I do. That I agree with, yes. And that we definitely know is happening. So the warmer tones, earthy tones, all of that is really, although we are seeing in design right now some big pops of color that are happening in the kitchen. So kind of the brighter count, you know, I just saw one the other day with a red cabinetry, which I don't have anything against red. It was just a lot in that particular home.
And it was stitched, remember? It was like a post.
Oh my gosh, that leather bridge that we saw was so pretty.
But
so even in cabinetry, I saw one the other day that was kind of that, you know, the blue, that sort of powdery blue countertop or cabinet, which, so we're seeing a lot of colors popping back in. So while most, it's still a neutral, it's still going to be those earthy tones. You're getting into the, away from the cold, stark colors, but into the warmer tones.
Right.
And I think we'll see more color coming into kitchens moving forward, colored cabinetry.
I agree.
You know, still the white countertops, that's still the clean, fresh look that most people are going towards. So, but agreed as far as colors.
These are the things that it's important to know as a developer.
It is. Especially, it is. And as you're a builder, you know, you're putting, we choose the selections.
A lot of times
every tile has to be selected, has to be chosen, has to be decided, and it has to be something that's neutral and relevant.
Marketable.
And on trend, exactly. With
warrantable. What's out there. You don't want to put a product that's a nightmare to warranty.
Good point. So.
That was a good question.
Design trends are, design trends are a big part of it. And especially as you backed it out into even just the exterior design. So, love it. Another good one.
Yeah.
All right. So I have a couple more here. You have time for a couple more?
I do.
A couple more?
Okay. I do.
Here's one. Ooh, that's a good one. That is a good one. AI. And this is something in the marketing world that I am up against a lot, and a topic that is forefront for myself and everybody else in the marketing industry. So
I think we're all thinking, you know, so this is saying, this question is asking, what do you think AI can do for building? So I'm going to sub out building with developing, because building is, you could be a project management company, you could be doing whatever.
Okay.
AI, in terms of the constructing of the home, so to answer the direct question, I think it's going to be challenging to see AI improve scheduling, and unless you're a really well-oiled machine, but construction is a messy, think on the fly, problem solving, in the moment, a lot of physical, tangible things. That I don't think AI is going to do much for the building industry. I think the developing industry, in terms of being a developer, I think maybe some of our economic analysis, we have one multifamily project that's needing an economist to kind of give us a pro forma on it, because it's so many units and so many doors in order to get the funding for it from the banks. They're wanting to see an economist actually sign off on, is it a viable project? Some of that thought work you might see, some of the analysis, or at least the compiling of data, might really be streamlined by AI. Ultimately, no bank is going to sign off on a $50 million loan that was generated by an AI chatbot from Microsoft.
No offense
to Microsoft. So I think that you're always going to want that human touch to do those, to kind of smooth out those edges. But I think a lot of the data harvesting and the analytics and just kind of compiling everything and getting it into digestible bites is going to maybe be streamlined by AI. And I'm actually going to ping pong it back to you for the marketing piece. What do you think marketing, how do you think marketing will be affected by AI?
It already is affected by AI in so many ways. And I was just going to say, last year when I went to CES conference here in Las Vegas, and then the Builder Show, National Association of Home Builders.
CES is Consumer Electronics Show.
Consumer Electronics, and then the Home Builders Association. Two separate shows, but hot topics at both were AI and things like even just the refrigerators. You know, the refrigerators all have that component built into them now. You can connect it to your phone and it can tell you temperatures, and it can read, you know, the wine we looked at the Builder Show.
Yeah, you can take a photo of your wine and you can go through your...
I think every, you know, your dishwasher and your washing machine, everything, all of the supplies and accessories that have gone into homes now are being tapped into AI. As far as the marketing side, there are things about AI that, again, can't be done. I know people who work in the interior design industry, and they do entire homes through AI. Mm-hmm. And it just is, it's, while yes, it gives you a general idea, it's really, really hard to narrow in on exacts when you're using
without
AI.
Without that human touch.
The other thing about AI is that you can't really use it for spoken. It's not good with fair housing. So it can say, you know, all of these elaborate things, but there are things in fair housing that we can't say, or that you have to, that you would want to steer away from, because we're not trying to pose the home to one buyer segment versus another. And AI doesn't necessarily have that intuitive language to determine that on its own. So while it can create great descriptions and things like that, they always have to be read. They always have to be run through the filter of a human. Otherwise, you're not getting the human touch. I think so much is being lost through AI.
Yeah.
That now people are beginning to get that kind of washed out feeling. And we're all kind of craving that, bring it back to the real. So so I hope we get back to real. I do had some, you know, there was a time where years ago, if you didn't jump in on the computer, you were getting left behind, right? The computer was here and you have to get on the internet. We're all going to be using email someday. I mean, years ago when people were going through that, I'm sure there was some resistance. But those people that never got a website are no longer in business.
Yeah.
So if our competitors are using it, or they got into the group, right? They had to either, you know, do it or be out. So I think AI is that same thing. It was that moment where I kind of had to realize, this doesn't feel good to me, but I know all of my competitors are using it. Every other builder in the industry is using it. All of the real estate agents in the world are using it. There has to be some piece of it that can streamline and help us too. So it's in my opinion, it's got to be a fine balance. And I think it's been so overused and so mass produced and everywhere that people are now beginning to crave that. Let's get back to the human touch again.
Do you think we went too early? Do you think AI should have been tweaked and honed a little bit more before it kind of was thrusted onto the public, and now we kind of have this? I see a lot of AI imagery is very hollow, and you can spot it a mile away.
You can see it a mile away.
And when you read it a mile away, I just, you know, you see these auto replies from different people in different industries, and you can tell the email was AI. And now I guess there's AI email extensions that will draft responses to emails that come in, and then you can just go into your drafts and hit send. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the receiving end of some of those as recently as last week, and then you read and go.
Yeah.
I'm not even going
to
finish reading it.
Or even the chat bots online. If you're on somebody's website and you're trying to get a question answered and you end up with this chat bot, you're like, this is clearly not a real person.
Right.
I'm going to pick up the phone and call, because
I
just need to talk to someone who can actually understand what I'm asking.
Right. And we're asking this in early part of 2025. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is like early part of 2025. Mm-hmm. So maybe this is like asking about the internet in 1989. I don't know.
I don't know.
So maybe it will get better. I don't see. I just updated our sales contract for our new home builds for what I call a piano disclosure. So a house is not a piano. It is imperfect. It's built on site by human hands out of imperfect, mostly natural materials. And as I was writing that, I realized, you know, it's one of those things. And that's why people love homes. It's so human. And everything.
And it is a little flawed. I mean, it's,
and that's
it's
part
not,
of its
yes,
charm. Right.
Yes.
It's good. Good.
Yes.
Because imagine the AI image of your house. It would feel hollow. Mm-hmm. But you know your house has dog scratches on it or whatever.
Right.
You know,
it's like an artist. You would much rather have a hand-painted versus some computer-generated image that you'd.
Right. And I could be partial here. Philip Holmes are art. And I think that it's not going to. You can. I've seen AI make architectural floor plans. And again, we might be talking about the internet in 1989. It has a long way to go. But it is an absolute train wreck. It just cannot be. An AI doesn't know how humans live and how humans want to live. And you can't train that very hard. I mean, I don't. I'm no AI expert. I barely know how to work my phone. So take what I say with a grain of salt. But
and when you say, did we release it too soon? I don't know if they expected it to take off the way that it did.
So
I think
just
when they just brought, you know, level one ChatGPT to the world, they thought, well, let's just see what happens. And it got so much response and so much momentum. And so then
it became a Wall Street darling. And
yes,
then all those
I think it's taken off
on
a life of its own. So maybe it did grow too much too fast and get incorporated into too many other places that now there isn't, you know,
we're not ready for it.
Washed out. Yeah.
This person also had another question. I'm starting to think these were written by robots. So this is Regulation Bot wrote this. Regulation Bot 2000. Why are you so anti-regulation? This person's got an axe to grind with me. I am not anti-regulation. I am frustrated by a lot of regulations, but I understand their place in the world. And we had a kind of a whole episode on this. And I think, and I'm sad if that was the takeaway from that episode, that I was anti-regulation, because I thought I was pretty emphatic that I appreciate regulation.
I think you covered both sides of it, and it isn't an anti-regulation necessarily as much as the hurdles that are put in place.
And,
yes,
and the fact that regulations never thin down; they only amp up, they only beef up, they only get thicker, sludgier. So I think those are the things. So
and that's a real part of home building. It's a part of any industry, but I think it's really a part of what you do. And so there is the obstacles that are put in place, and being transparent about that, and admitting that this isn't easy, and jumping through all of these hurdles and trying to, you know, cut all of these red tape and all of the things that you have to.
What's so challenging about it is that it's so fragmented, because building is largely dictated by the lowest form of your government. So whether it's a town, township, or even an HOA, the first clearance I have is with an, if I'm building an existing HOA, my first step is getting it cleared with the lowest rung of government, the first, you know, circle. So you're clearing that, then you're clearing that, then you're clearing that, then you're clearing that. So there's just so many layers of it. Whereas I feel like if I were building cars, you're dealing with mostly federal agencies. You're dealing with maybe, I'm sure, several. Again, I don't know how to build cars, but I can't even change my own oil or work my phone. So, but I just feel like what's so uniquely frustrating about developing and about housing and about building is just the layers of it, and how it starts with one person on a design review board can curtail, or, you know, can definitely derail your entire project. And I've had it happen before. One rogue board member on an HOA just didn't like me and made everything really challenging. And when they, and the reason I know it was them is because when they left the board, my life got a lot easier.
Interesting.
So it was going from 6-month approvals to 3-month approval. Like, oh, how did
and
that
some
happen?
Of that regulation, I feel like, is that just regulation for regulation's sake. And that was what we talked about. And there's a difference between regulations and codes, which would be a totally different question. But maybe just answer that quickly if you if you want to. Because I think people are confused by the structure that's put in place.
So a regulation would be, you can have this many homes per acre, or every 10 homes per acre, you have to have 1/4 acre of community space. That's more of a regulation. You could call that a development code, but it's more of a regulation. All codes are regulations, but not all regulations are codes. So every code is a regulation on the building industry. But a building code would be, egress windows have to be 44 inches from the floor and have to be at least 30 inches wide and 30 and 24 inches tall, or whatever, enough for a person to get out of. So that's a building code. A fire door going in a garage, it's a building code versus a regulation. So, but those are also regulations. But the, a regulation that's not a code is something like park space, or the fact that you need an HOA versus not. The fact that you have to have a hillside overlay study done, that's a regulation.
The fact that you need a signature on this document.
Yeah, the water district has to sign off on it. Public Works has to sign off on it. Traffic study, all those things. For even a 5-home subdivision has to have a traffic study. That's a regulation. That's, I mean, there can be, you could just have a house party and there'd be more people. You know what I mean? From versus a 5-home subdivision has to have a traffic study. But that's the study. There's only 5 homes and this is only this much traffic. So, but we have to count the number of cars that are on that road and how many trips are going to be generated by these homes. And just part of it. But those are the regulations that really slow things down and cost a ton of money. And there's just not a lot of smartness to it. There's not a lot of surgical precision to say, well, if it's under 50 homes, you don't need this, 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 this. That'd be a way of deregulating some of the industry. There's a lot of other regulations on street widths. And you're looking at a regular residential street might have a 45-foot wide street. And all that does is promotes on-street parking, clutters up the street, makes it hard for kids to play, because we know the wider the street, the faster the car goes. We just know that. That's why back east or in small European towns where there's trees on both sides and the street's only 14, they barely have speed limits, because you're going to go 20 miles an hour anyway, because you're just, your mind is going to slow your car down. So I just feel like those are the regulations that do nothing, in fact, make suburbia less livable. And of course, take up a ton more land. Every single street being 15 feet wider than it needs to be adds up over an entire just neighborhood, let alone a city. So those are the kind of regulations that are really hard to get behind, because I don't see the logic to them. So next question.
Next question.
Tired of this chat bot asking me questions. They probably asked the greedy one too.
Let's see. All right. How about... Ooh, this is a great one. Oh. We did touch on it a little bit, but you can circle back on that.
This is a good one.
Yeah, it circles back on what we talked about a little earlier.
And we kind of touch on this every time because it's something we're really passionate about.
It is, and it's a question people have because we're all affected by the prices out there.
And the question is, what do you think the biggest factor affecting them? They can't see it.
I know what I'm thinking about.
What do you think is the biggest factor? So they're asking for one. I can't give a multifaceted 20-minute answer here.
Yeah.
What do you think the biggest factor affecting home prices? It's supply. I mean, it's supply. So that's the bottom line. There's just not enough supply. We know that we're underbuilding in Las Vegas alone by about 8,000 rooftops, I think we figured, based on household generation. So that is the biggest factor. How do you fix that is the zoning and the regulation and cutting that kind of thing. And maybe incentivizing building instead of disincentivizing building and construction. Maybe tightening up some of the laws that consumers can sue builders for years after. It disincentivizes builders. City governments can block development and ask for extra things. And there's development fees. Those are all things that constrict supply. But the simple answer is supply. When we had more supply, homes were cheaper. So, and is it just supply construction? No, there's also a lot of homes kept off the market, owned by hedge funds, owned second homes. There's a lot of reasons we have constrained supply. And then a housing market is something that becomes obsolescent. There's an obsolescence to the housing supply, right? I mean, the homes can only go for so long without either needing massive improvement or not fitting the bill anymore. We're starting to see some teardowns in our city where the land value has become more than the home justifies, or maybe a densification in other cities. So if you look at, I think the National Association of Home Builders assumes the functional life of a house is around 70 years. So it doesn't mean that they fall down at 70 years, but it just means they would need such a substantial investment. The original home is basically zero because it requires so much investment.
And the chances of it still being over time, somebody has done the upgrades.
Yeah, does it ever go a full 70 years? No, probably not. But that only takes us back to 1950 when you think of 55. So that's not really, 70 years sounds like a long time. I'm picturing in my head a home from the 1920s, but that could be a 1955 Rambler, a little ranch home.
Yeah.
You know, that
yeah, but that is, by somebody's redone the roof, somebody has
ideally,
updated exactly. all, yeah.
But the thought is that over 70 years, they become basically worth zero. They require so much. So if you've not been maintaining.
Okay.
So that affects supply as well.
Okay. And we'll take one more of the questions. And this one, I like the thought on this one. As we talk about your role as a developer and some of the obstacles that you face, what's the most challenging?
What's the most challenging aspect of developing / home building? It's the time. It's just the amount of time to bring something to market is the single greatest. And that is not just because of regulation. That's just the time to build, the time to conceptualize. You're herding cats in many ways, right? I mean, just to get my architect to deliver on time and then that over to my engineers and get everyone talking. And those things just take time, even if there were no regulations. So it's not just regulations that slows things down. These are really complicated projects that we do. And we, even if it's just inside of an existing HOA, it's still a house. It's going to be there for, functionally, 70 years.
That's what you just said.
Right. So I think that's the biggest challenge is just the time and the patience. It requires an astounding amount of patience. So that's my biggest kind of frustration / thorn in my side. It's just the amount of time it takes to do anything.
And the time requires patience.
And the time requires patience and requires a lot of grit. That you have to have the stones to invest all this money up front and or take on all this debt or a combination of both. You usually have a lot of money invested in and a lot of debt. And you just say, I hope this works because it's too far in now. So... That's
well, good.
Challenge.
I love it. And thank you guys for...
Sparring now, so...
That's well, good. Challenge. I love it. And thank you guys for sending the questions. Really good conversation that we were able to start here. We'll do others. So if you have questions or if there's something on your mind you'd like us to address, feel free to send it. You can shoot it over to any of our online platforms and I will get those and we'll rally them together and address them in a future episode. So thank you so much.
Appreciate
it. And we'll see you guys again next time on another episode of Trust the Process podcast. See you then. Bye-bye.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.